of the homes, the businesses, and the people which had brought life and noise and colour to the area. Only burning embers and an eerily perfect crater remained. Such sudden and mysterious devastation. Over 80,000 dead. The planetary inquiry would last decades, but the truth would never emerge. Those who came close to it would vanish, and the event would eventually pass into local legend. All of it, for the sake of a single, simple word. The name of an insignificant backwater planet that was no longer part of the Imperium of Man. Tychonis, muttered the old Inquisitor Lord. He rose from his command throne, ignoring the stiffness in his joints, ordered a course set through the warp, and left the bridge in the hands of the ship's captain. As he stalked the gloomy stone corridor back to his quarters, he turned it over in his mind. The flames in the wall sconces danced and guttered as he swept past them.
Why, Tychonis, what drew you there? And why now?
Chapter 4. Halluck tried to swallow in a mouth suddenly dry. His heart raced. The black port of the gun barrel pointed right at his face seemed to swallow him. Time slowed to a crawl. There they stood, two men, one in civilian robes, death commando from the north, and the other.
What? ISF? A Tau-aligned Tychonite traitor?
The man was hard-faced, flint-eyed, roughly 10 years Halluck's senior. He was tall and broad, like most of the men that policed the capital, alongside the fire-caste troopers. For a long moment, the two simply stared at each other, barely breathing, nerves jangling. Then words.
Long we bled upon the open sand.
His tone was low, his voice gruff. Halluck breathed. The tension in his neck eased. He knew the response.
And from that sand, he said, shoots of truth and purpose did grow.
The man lowered his weapon. Not ISF, Hadayin, an infiltrator, a fellow servant of the cause. Still, he should have been gone already.
The drones just finished the pass.
He tapped a metallic Tau glyph on his uniform.
All they found was a member of the security forces running last-minute diligence. You'll have the window you need.
Halluck nodded. He wondered if the infiltrator was a city-born sympathizer or had come from the rebel tribes. Kashtu, Ishtu, and city-born, all were of tan skin and black hair. There was no way to know. Any giveaway in speech or manner would likely have got the infiltrator killed or imprisoned already. Hadayin's service to the cause depended on a flawless facade. Halluck respected such men. He knew the rawness of his hate for the Pogs precluded him from the kind of vital work they did.
You'll find the weapon at the top, said the infiltrator. Don't miss.
I won't, said Halluck, the mere suggestion of it irking him.
But why are you here? I was not told to expect you.
The man paused.
We were not meant to meet, it's true, but I wanted to leave something else for you up there. It took me a moment.
I don't understand.
A chance at life, Karkin. I anchored a rope to the tower wall.
Halluck scowled.
Do not be offended, said the Hadayin. I know you are ready to give your life, but if you move quickly, would the cause not be better served by your survival? Martyrs are a one-shot weapon. I've always thought it wasteful. If there's a chance,
the Speaker has seen my ascension to glory in the scrying sands.
The Speaker, said the man gravely.
He shrugged.
Then so it will be, I suppose. Fate is fate.
One did not doubt the speaker, least of all in the presence of a Kharkin. The infiltrator gave a shallow bow and resumed his descent. Haluk angled his body that the other might pass him on the narrow stair. As the man drew parallel, he offered his final words.
Saint Sathra, watch and keep you, Kharkin. Saint Isara, speed your soul on its journey. I'll hold your deed in memory and see the tale passed on.
He vanished round the curve of the staircase and was gone. But his words stayed with Haluk all the way to the top of the minaret.
So it will be. It has been foretold. My fate is set. Today I die.
He had thought himself ready, his acceptance complete, certain of the promise of elevation in the eternal life after this one. But now, chill slivers of doubt began to press at the edges of his faith. Fear and the animal need to survive gnawed at him. What about choice? What about free will? He did not doubt the speaker or his visions, but what if he turned around right now? What would happen to the cause? Just how much did the dreams of his people rest on his actions this day? Surely the future was not so binary a thing. Surely success in the years that followed did not rest on a single act of sacrifice today. Emerging from the stairwell at the top, he found himself high above the city, sheltered from the beating sun, and from any eyes overhead, by the eaves of the tower's sharply tilted roof. The sky was so wide and blue it seemed that the whole of existence lay beneath it. On the eastern side of the parapet, by the inner edge of the waist-high sandstone crenellations, he found the man-portable missile launcher he had known would be waiting for him. The weapon looked old, covered in scuffs and scratches. A one-shot weapon only, as was he.
It was foretold.
Damn the Hadaeen for igniting these doubts now. What if surviving to fight might make a bigger difference? No, the speaker would have seen that in the scrying sands. He was the God Emperor's instrument on Tychonis. It was by his visions and his leadership that the yoke of alien occupation would be thrown off. Haluk's death today would be a flagstone on the path to the redemption of his people and his world. His place in history was assured.
One shot.
The weapon's laser-targeting system meant Haluk wouldn't need more than that. His training had been comprehensive, strict, grueling. He was fully prepared. The missile was preloaded and the targeting systems were on standby. But as Haluk bent to lift the launcher, he felt a powerful urge to check something. Walking around to the other side of the tower, he spotted the coil of thick rope the sergeant had left for him. He reached down and tugged on it. It was anchored solidly to a plasteel piton. He growled at himself, again conflicted.
I should be past this. Why am I still torn? If I run, I risk being taken alive.
Capture was not an option. What might the Blueskins draw out from him? What terrible methods did the Pogs use? Committed to death in duty, Kharkin did not train in anti-interrogation methods. Haluk cursed himself for his momentary weakness and whirled away from the rope. He marched determinedly back to his firing position. Mere moments remained. Peeking over the lip of the wall, he surveyed the scene 40 meters below. The highway was thronged with people now, all jostling for position. Hab windows on every floor in every building were crammed. Mostly boys and men who had shoved, elbowed, and shouted their way past sisters, wives, and mothers to get a better view. The infiltrator had said the drones had completed their pass on the towers. Sure enough, they hovered over the lower rooftops now, guns and lenses tracking left and right, looking for potential threats. Haluk muttered a hateful curse as he watched. The air began to fill with the eerie humming of alien engines. Tau gunships swung into view from ramps and intersections along the highway, hovering a meter off the ground, sliding like insects on the surface of a pond into prearranged positions. Their guns swung to cover the dense assembly of a curious and colorful crowd.
"You see," thought Haluk, "safety and prosperity to all those who bow to the Tau Va, but little trust."
Members of the security forces made a long line on either side of the road, facing the masses, weapons in hand. Haluk was disgusted to see so many humans among them, proudly holding weapons across their chests, so ready to kill any of their own people who threatened their Tau masters. As he looked down at the spectacle-hungry masses and the might of the security forces restraining them, he felt himself being pulled headlong towards a nexus, a point in time on which great future events rested. More ground vehicles started to emerge from the heat and dust at the far end of the road now, engines adding their strange voices to the rest, creating a curious low vibration in Haluk's chest. First came a vanguard of sleek skimmers, their cockpits opened to the air. Then came two heavy craft bristling with gun barrels and missile racks. They had about them the visual aspect of an ocean predator, their hulls of metal and advanced ceramics curving and sweeping like organic forms. Then, at last, it appeared before him, the craft he had spent so long studying in vids and pics, visualizing in his mind. The overwhelming, overriding focus of the days and weeks leading up to this one. It was the personal vehicle of the blue-skinned wretch responsible for more Kashtu and Ishtu deaths on Tychonis than any other living being. Commander Coldwave. Haluk's whole body tensed. In that single moment, this thing which had dominated his thoughts for so long was made suddenly imposingly solid and real. Flanked by the support craft of an honor guard, it prowled along the highway, a heavily armored troop transport with the honor markings of the warrior leader to whom it belonged. As it glided closer to Haluk's position, he hefted the missile launcher and settled it on his right shoulder. The weight of it pressed down on him. He adjusted until he was about as comfortable and steady as he could make himself. The crowd below grew quiet, hesitant, watching in awe and respect. No cheering and clapping. The Tau found such raucous displays distasteful. The Fire Caste Supreme Commander had been in the South for months. He had always shunned the spotlight, and his movements were seldom made public knowledge. But the Speaker had known, long before this morning's public announcement over the Tychonite Infocast system, the Speaker had known that Coldwave would pass this way at this hour on this day, and a single Karkeen might thus strike a great blow against the enemy. The moment had come. Coldwave's devilfish armored transport slid into firing range. Chapter 5. With his heart pounding and a prayer on his lips, Haluk sighted through the lens of the missile launcher's scope and tracked right. The crosshairs rolled over the polished fuselage of the devilfish. He thumbed the safety off and pressed the activation room for the laser target designator. A bare moment after the invisible laser painted the side of the transport, the Tau military presence and their human cohorts jolted into action like they'd been stung. The energy in the whole area changed completely. Helmed faces whipped around towards Haluk's position, drones lifted from their holding pattern. Fireblade squad leaders started calling out to their cadres, gesturing sharply. Several squads broke from the road and started charging through the crowd, converging on the minaret from several places at once. So Coldwave's devilfish had a lock-on sensor. No matter, Haluk had his target dead center. He kept his right eye pressed to the weapon's scope. In the peripheral vision of his left, he noted three gun drones cutting straight towards him through the air. Blood roared in his ears. His brain was screaming at him to flee. Instead, he gritted his teeth, pushed the weapon's charge lever to active, pressed forward on the firing lever with his thumb and squeezed the trigger. The weapon roared, deafening him. He was almost blown from his feet. He shut his eyes involuntarily, blinded by the sudden ignition of rocket fuel. When he opened them half a second later, he saw a streak of white smoke arcing down towards the transport. He had time to marvel at the gentle, graceful curve of the trail before he was blinded again by the flare of the explosion. The noise was like a thunderclap, short and sharp. It reverberated in the stone beneath his feet. The tower shivered. Righteous zeal filled Haluk's wildly beating heart. He had done it. He had struck a blow against the usurpers in the name of the God Emperor and all that was right. The Tau Firecast leader was dead.
Be proud, Mother. Terra's holy light surely shines upon me now.
But Haluk was wrong in that. Perhaps the Emperor's attention was elsewhere that day. Luck certainly was not with him. As he let the launcher drop at his feet, he watched the smoke clear, pulled away like a veil caught on a breeze. The sight it revealed made him cry out in denial. Down in the streets, people were shoving and scrambling to get away from the main thoroughfare, desperate to get back to the cover of the alleys and away from more explosions. Shutters slammed over the windows that faced onto the highway. The security forces were forming a cordon around what should have been the twisted, burning wreckage of the transport. Should have been. The transport was untouched, not even blackened by the blast. But how? The missile had exploded. Haluk had done everything he had been trained to do. Burning debris should have been raining down from the sky. Those inside should have been so much charred meat. Haluk felt like his heart had dropped out of his chest. But there was no time to stand and try to process it all. The drones were almost on him. The knowledge that he had failed to kill the Tau military leader changed everything. This was not the glory he had been promised. He was no longer content to die here, not now. The promise of eternal reward had been snatched from him, his most fervent hopes undone. Giving himself over completely to the survival instinct he had been wrestling with, he raced around the walkway to the other side of the tower, grabbed a double armful of the coils of the infiltrator's rope, and heaved its length out over the crenellations. The rope plunged downwards, uncoiling as it fell. It stopped just a few meters short of the ground. The hum of the drones was pressing on his ears. They swung around the sides of the tower, two from the left, one from the right. Just as Haluk took firm hold of the rope and pitched himself over the edge. He swung out in a controlled spin and landed his feet against the wall. From there he began a frantic descent. The drones swept in closer, descending in parallel with him, taking up position 4 meters off to his sides and rear. A burst of flat Tau speech, mechanical and lifeless, emanated from all three at once. Haluk ignored it, his mind given over completely to the descent. The voice switched to Urzi, the most common variant of Tychonite Low Gothic, the official human language of occupied Tychonis.
Cease all movement immediately.
Desperate now, hardly thinking at all, Haluk switched from arm over arm. He hooked the rope into the crook of his arm and began to drop at speed, the fabric of his robes protecting him from burning abrasion. He dropped fast, but the drones dropped with him, guns leveled.
Cease movement. This is your final warning.
Only 10 meters to the ground. 9, 8, 7. When the guns fired on him, it was the sound more than the explosive pain of the pulse rounds smacking into his flesh that snapped his focus away from the rope. So distinctive, that strange, angry buzz. His strength left him completely. He lost his grip, plunging the rest of the distance to the ground below, hitting it with a loud, wet crack. The back of his skull shattered. A pool of hot, thick blood began to spread out around his head. Light swarmed and danced behind his eyelids. He opened them and looked up at the sky, cloudless and blue. In his peripheral vision, he saw the drones settle around him in a cordoning pattern. They turned their guns outwards. He was no longer any threat. Everything was growing dark. He heard the sound of many pairs of booted feet running towards him. There was shouting in both Erzi and Tau. Haluk was fading fast. He couldn't turn his head to see, but he sensed he was being surrounded. Figures moved at the edges of his vision. Suddenly, the flat, noseless face of a Tau fire warrior leaned over him, close and low, scowling, snarling, barking a string of questions in that arrogant, contemptible way common to all Pog soldiers. Haluk tested his right arm gingerly. It moved, albeit painfully slowly. With great effort, he forced his hand into the folds of his robe. The officer leaning over him snapped ferociously, this time in Erzi.
"Don't move, Gwella! You are dying!"
Haluk felt his hand close over the tiny device he sought. Through blooded lips, he grinned. Perhaps a little glory, after all.
"Pro Terra Imperator," he wheezed, blood bubbling from his mouth.
He pressed the small red button on the detonator and ignited the explosives under his robes, ending his part in the liberation of his world. 8 Tau security personnel died in the capital that day. All kills of the Ishtu death commando Haluk Uzkalan. 4 human security officers also died immediately in the blast. The 3 drones that had gunned the rebel down were blown to hot fragments. A further 16 members of the Tau and human security forces were injured. The greater effects of the attack were felt only after, and for much longer, just as the Speaker of the Sands had always intended. Cold Wave had never been a viable target, not for so simple a plan as this. The real target that day was unity, the cross-species trust between the people of Tychonis and their blue-skinned overlords. In the climate of surging doubt and tension that sprang from the attack, and in the months of increased security measures that followed Haluk Uzkalan's death, not just in the bustling districts of Chuzut-Kar, but in all the integrated towns and cities, thousands of men and women were forcefully detained for questioning. Those with something to hide were subjected to measures few would have expected of the Tau. People vanished. Some were released, not because they were thought innocent, but because observing them might lead Tau intelligence operatives to higher value suspects. Among the people of the souks and recaf houses and narco dens, words of criticism and outrage became more common. Perhaps the greater good was not all it purported to be, men whispered to each other. Perhaps, despite all the promises, some were more equal than others in the glorious Tau regime. That was what the Speaker of the Sands had sought to gain. That was what Haluk Uzkalan's life bought for the loyalist cause. Chapter 6. The room never changed, and why would it? Those who met within cared not at all about its decor or lack thereof. After all, it did not actually exist. It was a no-room, a psychic construct only, a simple tool, nothing more. It allowed the 2 minds now occupying it to discuss matters of great import without the distraction and discomfort of total astral disembodiment. Those minds were projected and maintained in that ethereal space by the life-sapping, flesh-withering efforts of their individual psychic choirs, each a collection of lobotomized psychic minds, all slaved to their respective master astropaths. This was what it took to bridge the vast distance between the Saint Nevar and the Lance of Sion, two ships currently almost half a segmentum apart. The table in the center of the no room was of the same unnaturally symmetrical grain as before. The flames in the wall sconces still guttered and danced in strange synchronicity, each a copied instance of a single fixture. The chairs were plain, their surfaces neither warm nor cold, neither hard nor soft. There was only enough detail, enough realism, to appease the human mind so that it might disregard the surroundings as utterly mundane. No, the room had not changed since the last time these two met in secret conclave. But much else had.
"The Master Astropath confirms we are secure on our side," said one.
"Likewise at this end, my lord, cleared to proceed," replied the other.
The simplicity of this astral environment had another benefit. It was easy to spot glitches. Had any asymmetry crept into the psychic fabric of the room, any hint of unexpected detail, the implications would have been significant and the course of action immediate. The meeting would be ended at once. Anything at all, a single flame out of sync with the others, or some tiny variance in the table's grain, would mean outside interference. A psychic intrusion attempt. A breach. It could come from a thousand different sources, for many were the minds that longed to hear the most secretive sessions of the Emperor's Holy Inquisition. Whatever the source of an infiltration, the result would be the same: instant termination of the mindscape and an immediate return to the physical realm. As ever, there was too much at stake.
"No," thought Omicron, "this is different. The stakes are even higher now."
It was a dark thought. So much work, so much progress since night harvest. Black Seed was further along than ever. So much had fallen into place. Now it all hung by a thread. A full century ago, when he first set foot on this long and arduous road, taking the mantle of Omicron and all its attendant responsibilities from his late mentor, he would never have believed he might actually come this far. The opposition had proved less competent than he had first given them credit for. Far from fools, of course. Deceivers and exploiters all. Manipulators and illusionists, puppeteers and gamesmen of the very highest order. But in taking them on, their very capabilities had brought out his own, and thus far at least, his had consistently proved the superior. Only he hadn't foreseen this. Not this. The members of the Ordo played the most dangerous of games. Assets disappeared. Many were tortured and killed. Others simply never heard of again. And as many questions went unanswered as not. But this time, one of his own, one of his best and brightest and most highly placed. His hooded avatar leaned forward across the table and stared at the identically cowled figure seated there.
"Sigma."
Omicron had invested 5.5 decades in this one. Time well spent. That investment had been returned many times over.
"I knew you'd be worth it. You had the right kind of fire in you. And exactly the kind of Achilles heel I needed to draw out your best."
The boy and his sister, she deathly ill, had been stowaways on an Imperial freighter. Omicron had been tracking the illegal movement of Xenos technology between cells of a multi-system extremist pro-alien terrorist group. He had thought to find Eldar shuriken rifles in the freighter's hold. Instead, he found a boy who would in time evolve to be a far deadlier weapon. He chuckled scornfully at himself, still surprised on occasion at the strength of this patriarchal pride. Naively, He had thought himself beyond such feelings. Some within the Ordo thought him a paragon of ruthless, cold efficiency. They would have been surprised to know he was still so human. But such feelings were a weakness, nonetheless. And that was something he could not abide.
The blade that kills you is the one you least expect.
He hardened himself. There was deadly business to discuss. High-level assets would have to be put on the line. There would be deaths, very probably Space Marine deaths.
Epsilon has gone off-grid. Dark, without authorization.
On the other side of the table, Sigmar's avatar stiffened visibly. The weight of the words and their implications hung there in the astral space between them.
"Probability she's dead?" asked Sigmar. "What does your coven say?" "Dead would be simpler, old friend." "Yes," he thought. "Let him hear me say, friend. The bonds must remain strong, more so now than ever before." "And we would not be talking now," continued Omicron. "But my coven has been scouring the ether since she missed her last transmission deadline, and it appears her soul is still grounded in the physical realm. Were it disembodied, the coven could have forced it into seance. Their divinations are not often wrong, and their conviction is strong on this one. I am inclined to believe them. She is not an easy one to kill. They also believe there is a significant event nexus in her near future. Highly significant. And that makes the problem of her disappearance all the greater."
Of course, there were ways of being dead without one's soul transcending. And there were countless reasons why an Inquisitor of Epsilon's rank and responsibilities might fail to report as ordered, none of which were reassuring. In every single case, the implications for all that Omicron and his faction had been working towards could not have been more grave.
"How long has she been missing?" asked Sigmar. "How overdue is her last astropathic contact?" "The tower on Galathis was due to relay a status report 43 days ago. The listener there reports no transmissions forthcoming. Nothing got through, not to Galathis, nor to any of the other relays. No distress calls, no fragments, nothing. Epsilon's movements for the last 91 days are a blank."
Sigmar's avatar leaned forward, elbows on the table, and clasped bone-white hands. "The very difficulty of tracing an agent who has deliberately gone dark is testament to the training you gave us. She may have had no choice. There's a chance that seeking her out is the wrong play here." Omicron nodded.
"I've accounted for that. But this goes well beyond the usual protocols. There are signals she could have given prior to dropping off the map."
"What of her revenue? Her assets?
Someone must know something. Even dead bodies tell tales. Those we could locate, we picked up. Interrogations proved fruitless for the most part. Members of her network either knew nothing or opted not to cooperate, loyal unto death. Significantly, a number of those interrogations were cut short. Our opponents within the Ordo have been particularly proactive and tenacious. Armed elements stormed several of our active sites. A number of operators under my own direct command were lost as a result.
You exacted an appropriate price of your own, I'm sure.
Omicron allowed himself a slight smile.
Oculum pro oculo. I'm confident the opposition gained nothing tangible. They will still be smarting from their last attempt. But this is the most overt move our political enemies have ever made against us. The implications are twofold, I think.
That they were watching for just such an opportunity, and that they believe there is a chance they can get to Epsilon first, said Sigmar.
Omicron nodded.
They have never had such a fine chance. To acquire one of the core members of our cabal, one I trusted as deeply as I trust you, trained in the same way and to the same ends, someone who knows enough to destroy Blackseed and all we have built. Yes, it's worth almost any price to them. They must be frothing at the prospect. Were I in their shoes, I would spare no effort.
Sigmar shifted, leaning back in his chair, arms sliding from the table to settle on its armrests.
There is, of course, the possibility that they have Epsilon already, and the strikes are a ruse to cover it. Could she have defected? I mean no offense, my lord, but much as it pains me, it would not be the first time an Ordo Inquisitor has switched allegiance.
Omicron felt the same brief wash of denial he'd felt when that very thought had first occurred to him. But feelings changed nothing. Epsilon may indeed have gone over. Still, even as he admitted this to himself once again, his gut rejected it. It just didn't strike him as truth.
I can't rule it out, he said. But her indoctrination and psycho-conditioning were every bit as comprehensive as your own. You share many qualities, you and she. Her loyalty has never been in doubt, nor her commitment to our ultimate aims. Something else is afoot here. I'll not believe her a defector until I have exhausted all other possibilities.
Xenos, then, offered Sigmar. Epsilon may have been taken captive before she could signal. I am assuming, of course, that as part of Blackseed, she was conducting an operation with a high probability of hostile contact.
Capture was my first thought. On the surface, an obvious answer. But why, then, the resistance from her assets during interrogation? We are not talking about mere conditioning. There was hope, faith. They went to their deaths willingly, with knowledge they would not share at any price.
Nothing was extracted? At all?
Sigmar's surprise was warranted. Ordo methods always ensured something to work with.
Ultimately, we were able to snag a single thread. It cost us much. And now we get to it, to the moment I put you in play. A single word is all we have to go on. Tychonis.
Sigmar's avatar paused as the Inquisitor searched his memory. No, nothing. The avatar shook its hooded head.
Tychonis, said Omicron, was a low-yield imperial fringe world until it was cut off by the warp storm Oculus Draconis, the dragon's eye.
That storm abated a century ago, said Sigmar. The system was not reintegrated.
It was a desert world. Low population. Low to mid-value natural resources only. The proposal was scrapped over costs. For a while, the human population was victim to the depredations of the Dark Eldar. The Tau swept in, eliminated that threat, and turned the planet into a fertile agri-world during their last expansion.
The Tau? What was she doing in Tau space? You're sending me in, of course, so I'll need access to her records.
What I can share, under emergency protocols, I will transmit to your ship's archives at once. There will be omissions for your own sake as well as mine. Encryption will make processing slower than I'm sure you would like. But you'll understand the need when you review the material. Once you've processed it, make your initial assessment of the assets you require. I'll see you have everything you need. Because, mark me well, locating and recovering Epsilon is the most important thing I have ever asked of you. Failure in this is not an option. Only a handful know the truth about Black Seed, and each of those knows only their part. Epsilon, however, she knows enough to end it then. She has been to Facility 52. She has overseen key aspects of the work and more besides. Enough that were it to come out, every last one of us would be declared traitorous and marked for death. Of the Cabal, nothing would remain. Of all we have achieved to date, only ash. Let me reiterate. We face not only the fall of Black Seed, but the collapse of everything you and I have ever built in the name of mankind. There will be no mercy for us.
Sigmar leaned forward on the table again, head bowed in thought.
And if we find her, I need answers. Why did she go dark? If she has talked, to whom and of what? How much has been compromised? What are the ramifications? I cannot get these things from a corpse, and I cannot plan countermeasures without them.
I understand, my lord. Tychonis, then. If she is there, my assets will find her.
I have already activated sleepers within the Tychonite populace. The blue skins are watchful. Like the Eldar, they are not easily deceived. But also, like the Eldar, their weakness lies in their arrogance, their self-assurance. Agents on the ground have been told what to look for. I await word. The time and distance involved.
Why was Epsilon in Tau space?
She was initially deployed to the Eastern Fringe in order to covertly observe their military operations against Tyranid incursions there. She was never tasked with going to Tychonis. Her last reported movement was groundfall on a world called Dalix. The Tau had fallen to the Tyranids there 2 decades prior. A dead husk of a world is all that remains now. But decrypted Tau records secured in a previous kill team operation led her to seek out an old research facility. Since their first clashes, The Tau have been looking for an answer to the Tyranid problem as desperately as we have. Why she would ultimately end up on Tychonis is a mystery. If indeed that is where you'll find her. She was tasked with observation only, with one proviso. In the event that a nascent gene-stealer presence was discovered on a Tau-populated world, Epsilon was to secure several Tau specimens, male and female both, infected with the Tyranid gene seed.
Sigmar's head lifted at that, the sharp movement betraying his surprise.
An extension of Blackseed.
After a second, he nodded.
Of course. The Blueskins have no known psychers. The potential benefits to the project. It should have been obvious to me.
Peace, my friend, said Omicron. The scope of the project has grown. You were assigned to other critical work. Blackseed would not be so far along but for all you achieved with Night Harvest. The inclusion of Tau subjects in the program is potentially promising, yes, but it is merely an offshoot, an avenue of research that has yet to prove its worth.
If she is unrecoverable, do you wish me to secure infected Tau specimens?
If she cannot be recovered, you will take over her mission and procure them for transport to Facility 52. Detailed orders will follow by astropathic link. Our time here is almost up. To risk maintaining this astral space any longer invites intrusion or a trace. All relevant files will be transferred to the Saint Nevar. Make your resources request once you have reviewed the data. Assign assets as you see fit. But spare nothing in pursuit of your goal. As you will see from the files, Tychonis is firmly in Tau hands. Consult your coven. A kill team will need to be deployed.
Scimitar, then, my lord.
No, thought Omicron. Not scimitar. At least not just scimitar.
He had been told, warned, by that enigmatic voice in his mind, a voice he thought of as the Great Herald, that his ambitions would falter with the exorcist Routh and the death spectre Lyandro Karras, not somehow brought into the middle of all of this. But would the death spectre recover in time?
Talon, said Omicron. If the kill team Alpha can heal and deploy in time, his skills could be pivotal to recovering Epsilon.
Scimitar are more experienced, more obedient, my lord, countered Sigmar. Codicea Karras has never fought the Tau outside of simulations and sensorium relays.
Omicron shook his head.
Broden is too rigid, too orthodox to lead an operation like this. Scalpel over sledgehammer, at least until we know more. Night Harvest could have collapsed into disaster. Karras is the reason it did not. Experience aside, he and his team are the better choice, though you ought to place him under the tactical command of one with more direct experience of the Tau.
Sigmar bowed.
Your will be done, Lord. I have just such a one. But the Death Spectre will not like it. None of them will.
They are Death Watch, replied Omicron with a wry smile. It is not in their mandate to like it. Just make sure they get the job done.
Omicron rose from his chair, signalling an end to the discussion. But Sigmar was not quite finished.
One last thing, my lord.
Ask it, said Omicron.
Epsilon.
Did she have a Death Watch kill team with her?
That was astute, thought Omicron.
Good. 8 operatives, battle-hardened, excellent service records. No word from any of them.
A librarian?
Omicron's avatar shook its head.
None with psychic aptitude.
Sigmar nodded.
If that is all, said Omicron, go, and know that I trust you to resolve this in nomine imperator.
Sigmar also rose from his chair. He bowed.
In nomine imperator.
With that, the room around them began to dissolve, to peel and flake, rising up like ash on a warm current, as if the whole illusion were a painting on fire or paper being burned from a wall. So too did the cloaked avatars disintegrate until nothing of them remained. The minds of the two Ordo Xenos Inquisitors snapped back into their respective bodies, and the voices of the astropathic choirs which had been raised in him gradually lowered. The song ended on a last long and mournful note. Minutes later, the master astropath aboard the Saint Navarre started to receive highly encrypted data. He gave himself over to the deepest of trances. His eyes rolled back into his head. His hands began scribbling madly, frantically, on the reams of parchment placed in front of him. When the writing stopped, his servants rolled his work into tight scrolls and delivered them into the hands of the acolytes on the Mechanicus decks for cryptocogitator processing. 3 hours later, seated in an antique ironwood and grox leather chair in his private quarters, Sigmar finished absorbing the last of the details. The hyperfocus drugs he had taken were starting to wear off, right on time. Over ship comms, he ordered Kashkar Redthorn, ship's captain, to make for the way station at Mandrake Point. It was a trading and refueling hub, roughly midway between Dameroth and the edge of the Tau Empire. Already, plans were forming in his mind. The Saint Navarre swung around to face Galactic East, her warp engines powered up, prickling the skin of all aboard. Moments later, she punched a boiling white hole in the immaterium, then plunged into it like a spear cast into churning waters. The turbulent rift in reality closed behind her. Operation Shadowbreaker had begun. Chapter 7. Time, like the torrents of the Black River, flows only in one direction. But like those ethereal currents that carry one's soul to the afterlife, it does not flow uniformly. There are rapids and crashing falls and gentle, slow-moving shallows. Moments of joy and victory seem to flash by. Moments of pain and torment seem to last an age. Karras could no longer sense these currents. The flow had become immeasurable to him. There was nothing to gauge it by. He existed. This much he knew. He could think. He could wonder. His conscious mind was intact. But he had struggled up from the inky black of oblivion into a world entirely of the mind. He could no longer sense any physical form. Nothing to tell him he still had fingers or eyes or either of his two hearts. All he had was thought. And at first his awareness hung in a void of utter nothingness, waiting. Lost. Eventually the colour and landscape of memory slowly drifted into focus around him. He saw the skull and scythe's iconography of his chapter engraved on 1,000 mausoleum doors. He saw votive candles winking in the orange gloom of a corner of the reclusium. He saw broad-backed figures bowed in prayer before an altar on which lay weapons of war once wielded by legends. There were other memories, too. Things he struggled to recognize or reconcile with. Fragments of another life. These were memories of a past his Space Marine conditioning had long suppressed, but had never truly erased. A forest filled with the sounds of battle. So real. Gunshots echoed off the black trunks. A woman screamed his name, begged him to run. His mother. He ran, but his legs were short. His lungs small, those of the child he had been. Thorny branches in the frigid air stabbed at him as he sped between the trees. A great roar sounded from ahead and to the left. Something vast and black ripped through the sky so close the dead branches rained down around him. There was a boom that shook the earth. A wall of flame reared up right before him. He swung right and ran harder, putting everything he had into pumping his arms and legs. He didn't turn to look behind. He could feel the heat on his calves and the back of his neck. Fire wanted to engulf him, to wrap itself around him and greedily consume his flesh. Behind him, burning trees cracked and collapsed. Their fall made the flames surge, rearing up like bright dragons tossing their mighty heads, all violence and rage. But they wouldn't catch Lyandro Karras. He was the son of the hunt leader, fleetest of foot and strongest of sinew among the children of the Akosha. No mere fire would take him, not if he just kept running. Up ahead, there was a break in the trees. He sprinted for it. In his focus on the chaos behind him, however, he had neglected to keep note of precisely where he was. On any other day, he would have known that the eastern edge of the forest marked the lip of the great chasm. They called it Talon's Fate, though many more than the mythological Talon had found their end at the bottom. In all the fear, panic, and confusion, Karras didn't have time to think of where he was running to, only of getting away. He burst from the trees at full tilt. There was no way he could have stopped himself. His eyes went wide the moment he knew what he'd done. Time slowed to a crawl. He watched his right foot thrust out ahead of him to step down on nothing but empty air. Momentum carried him straight over the edge. Dark death yawned up at him. His eyes stared down into the black abyss that was about to claim his life. No death by fire, then, nor by the growling blades of the grotesque red giants which had just stormed his village. Gravity. Gravity would kill him. At least it would be quick. Just as his heart leapt into his throat and his body began its descent, something swept out across the edge of his peripheral vision. Something, a deep, dark blue, cold and hard as stone. It hit him across the midsection and encircled his waist. Karras's fall was suddenly and violently arrested. Breath exploded from him. He hung in midair, looking down at the deep black bottom of the chasm's vast, hungry throat. His heart was pounding like a hammer beneath his ribs. The thing that held him drew him back over the lip of the abyss. He saw the deadly void slide away, to be replaced by beloved brown earth, pine needles, and patches of unmelted snow. He was breathing hard, his 9-year-old lungs still aflame with the effort of the escape and the adrenal blitz of imminent death. He felt something grip his upper arm. With absolute ease, as if he weighed nothing, he was turned around in midair, and found himself staring straight into the terrible visage of his saviour. How well he remembered that moment. The bravest, most reckless boy of the tribe had frozen in abject fear. Never had he seen such a face. Skin the white of sun-bleached bone, with beard and eyebrows to match. Eyes like pools of fresh spilled blood. No whites. It was a face straight from the haunting tales old Shedak would tell by the light of the cooking fires. Cut it. The word rang loud in his mind. An old word from a language he'd never heard, and yet, looking into that wise and terrible face, its meaning had been as clear as a mountain stream. Visions came attached to it, visions of gloomy places where bodies were shaped by pain and ancient knowledge, of dark chambers where impossible things were taught and mastered.
"We must get you away from here," said the giant, and his voice was so deep that Karras could feel the words shaking his ribs. "We must get you out while they are still distracted."
As Karras recalled this, relived it, he realized he had never learned who they were. Space Marines, of course, as he knew now. Heretics from one of the accursed traitor legions. But in all the years since, over 100 of them, his giant savior had never spoken of that day. All too soon, psycho-conditioning and the demands of Space Marine selection had programmed Karras to neither ask nor care. Why, as he hung in an unknowable void, was it all bubbling up within him now?
Memories of childhood run deep. Suppressed, yes, but never truly erased. What has happened to me? Why is this coming back to me now? Where am I?
He let the memory continue to play out. Still holding the child he had just snatched from the air, the albino giant had angled his head and spoken into a transmitter on his gorget. A string of sharp words Karras hadn't understood. There was no mistaking the tone of command, though. Moments later, thunder filled the sky, echoing along the canyon walls. A great ship, the color of charcoal, swung into view, its rear ramp already lowered. It hung there in the air above Talon's fate, jets growling, spewing fire. The giant had slung Karras over one massive armored shoulder and leapt. Karras saw the ground fall away, and the abyss yawn beneath him once again. His stomach flipped with resurging fear. His savior's boots clanged loudly as he landed on the outstretched ramp. The aircraft dipped an inch with the impact, then nosed left and thrust upward. With his left hand, the giant grabbed the edge of the craft's fuselage and pulled himself and Karras further inside.